أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful.
Assalamu alaikum. Hello. Welcome to the Sufi Study Circle podcast. I am your host, Bill Whitehouse, and my Sufi friends call me Anab. I have been traveling sometimes more quickly and sometimes much more slowly on the Sufi path for over 40 years. I am not a Sufi sheikh, but I would like to use the contents of this podcast as a means of sharing with you some thoughts, ideas, possibilities, values, and principles concerning the Sufi spiritual way. Each edition of the Sufi Study Circle podcast will feature various selections concerning poetry, essays, readings from traditional sources, and reflections that give expression to different dimensions of the Sufi path. In addition, there also will be several musical interludes included that offer a change of pace of sorts. So relax, melt into the comfort of your chair, close your eyes, and permit me to take you on an excursion through some of the unrestricted regions of the Sufi spiritual path.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful.
اقرأ باسم ربك الذي خلق خلق الإنسان من علق اقرأ وربك الأكرم الذي علم بالقلم علم الإنسان ما لم يعلم كلا إن الإنسان ليطغى أن رآه استغنى إن إلى ربك الرجعى.
Read in the name of thy Lord who createth. Created man from a clot. Read, and thy Lord is the most bounteous. Who teacheth by the pen, teacheth man that which he knew not. Nay, but verily man is rebellious, that he thinketh himself independent. Lo, unto thy Lord is the return.
أرأيت الذي ينهى عبدا إذا صلى أرأيت إن كان على الهدى أو أمر بالتقوى أرأيت إن كذب وتولى ألم يعلم بأن الله يرى كلا لئن لم ينته لنسفعا بالناصية ناصية كاذبة خاطئة فليدع ناديه سندع الزبانية كلا لا تطعه واسجد واقترب.
Hast thou seen him who dissuadeth a slave when he prayeth? Hast thou seen if he relieth on the guidance of Allah, or enjoineth piety? Hast thou seen if he denieth Allah's guidance and is froward? Is he then unaware that Allah seeth? Nay, but if he sees not, we will seize him by the forelock, the lying sinful forelock. Then let him call upon his henchmen, we will call the guards of hell. Nay, obey not thou him, but prostrate thyself and draw near unto Allah.
The foregoing Quranic recitation was by Qari Wahid Zafar Qasmi. It gives expression to Surah 96, the Clot. In many, if not most, of the first seven editions of the Sufi Study Circle podcast, the recitation of the Quran has been followed by a few brief observations. Such observations are not intended to serve as an interpretation of the Quran, nor are they intended to serve as a commentary concerning the Quran. Rather, when reading or listening to the recitation of the Quran, there often are occasions when certain ideas and thoughts come to mind. I refer to such observations as Quranic resonances. That is, something in the recitation or reading of the Quran resonates with something in me, and the observations that ensue give expression to such resonances. Today's Quranic resonance is as follows. There is a difference between those who seek to generate confusion concerning the nature of reality and those who are sincere seekers of God. Some individuals believe they are independent agents in the world, and while ensconced in such a delusional worldview, seek to dissuade people from praying to God or seek to induce people not to guard against doing acts of evil. Such individuals are inclined to lie about issues both large and small, as well as to turn their backs on those who are in need. The way of the sincere seekers of God are those who realize that human origins are very humble. They are individuals who have been brought to understand by the grace of Allah that through God's bounty one has an opportunity to develop the potential that is present in such humble beginnings. God teaches those who are open to being taught. Moreover, God teaches such individuals what cannot be otherwise acquired. Each of us has a choice. We can choose to follow the example of those who are sincere in their search for the truth, or we can follow the example of those who are charlatans and are immersed in a life of self-deception. The title of today's edition of Friday Thoughts is Rational Mysticism. In 2003, John Horgan released a book, Rational Mysticism, Spirituality Meets Science in the Search for Enlightenment. Horgan had become a science writer in the 1980s. While Horgan believed that science offered the best way to proceed with respect to acquiring knowledge in general, nonetheless, he also felt that science was not necessarily capable of uncovering all of the mysteries of existence. Consequently, the aforementioned book explored the possibility that some sort of blending of science and mysticism might serve as a viable method for pursuing spiritual enlightenment. There are a number of issues that arise in conjunction with the title of Horgan's book, namely, Rational Mysticism, Spirituality Meets Science in the Search for Enlightenment. For example, is the idea of quote-unquote rational mysticism oxymoronic, that is, a contradiction in terms? If not, then what exactly is meant by the idea of rational mysticism? Is spirituality the same thing as mysticism, or are there differences between the two terms? What is enlightenment? Is it one epistemological condition, or does enlightenment consist of a variety of kinds and levels of understanding? Can science and mysticism ever really meet? If not, does this mean that mysticism is inherently illogical and irrational? Let's start with the issue of enlightenment. What is the relationship between enlightenment and truth? From the Sufi perspective, the truth can never be exhausted. Therefore, whatever enlightenment might be, it constitutes a grasping of truth up to some unknown point, which is marked on the one hand by an individual's capacity for knowing the truth, and on the other hand by the divine grace that is extended to any given individual's potential for understanding the truth, and which activates that potential to one degree or another. Consequently, enlightenment is a process of realizing the truth to greater degrees according to one's capacity and God's grace. As such, enlightenment is not necessarily one state or condition, but alludes to an array of possibilities concerning the realization of one or another facet or dimension of truth. Consider the following story. A Sufi initiate entered the courtyard of the house where his spiritual guide lived. The initiate was proclaiming, "I have seen God! I have seen God!" His sheikh came out to calm the man down and asked the latter individual to provide a description of the experience. After calming down, the man recounted what had occurred. Upon hearing the man's account, the sheikh indicated to the man that he was a silly fool. All that the young man had experienced was the light or nur of his ablution or state of ritual cleanliness. Apropos the foregoing considerations, there is a telling story concerning my Sufi teacher. Although my spiritual guide became a sheikh quite independently of his academic achievements, he did earn a doctorate in England. His external examiner was A.J. Arbery, who was an internationally recognized scholar with respect to both Islam and the Sufi path. Professor Arbery had converted to Islam while translating the Quran, but kept his conversion quiet because of prejudices concerning Islam and Muslims that existed within various academic circles at the time, a situation that, to varying degrees, has grown steadily worse over the last 50 years. Professor Arbery described my future spiritual guide's dissertation as the best work on the Sufi path that he had seen in the English language. High praise indeed, and over the years my sheikh thought about publishing that dissertation. However, after he went through several 40-day periods of seclusion, following his being given the responsibilities associated with becoming a sheikh, he felt that if the thesis were going to be published, then the manuscript would have to be revised in order to take into account what he had learned and experienced during his periods of seclusion. With each additional period of seclusion, the need to revise the original manuscript became greater, because there was an increasing gap between the level of understanding given expression in his dissertation and the spiritual understandings that were arising through his periods of seclusion. The thesis manuscript never did get revised. Moreover, my spiritual guide decided against publishing it despite its being described by A.J. Arbery as being the best treatment of the Sufi path that was available in the English language at that time. My sheikh sometimes mentioned a quote of a friend of his, someone who was also a Sufi sheikh, that bears upon the following anecdote. His friend had once said that there have been so many Rumis who have never uttered a word. The Sufi path is like an iceberg. While there is a certain amount of the path that has visibility above the vast ocean of mystical understanding that lies beneath such surface phenomena, and the writings of people such as Rumi, Hafiz, Attar, and Ibn al-Arabi, may Allah be pleased with them all, have helped give expression to that sort of visibility. Nonetheless, for the most part, the deeper truths of the path are hidden from view and are rarely spoken of, although allusions to such realities might find their way in the various lines of poetry or in occasional discourse. Ibn al-Arabi, may Allah be pleased with him, wrote the Meccan Revelations based on a series of spiritual experiences or unveilings that took place in Mecca over a very short period of time. When completed, the book covered more than 10,000 pages, and yet this vast expanse of pages constituted only the portion of those experiences that could be mentioned, a very small subset of the understandings that arose in conjunction with the foregoing experiences. Sufis often use the term hal, state, and maqam, station, to refer to different kinds and levels of enlightenment. Usually hal gives expression to transitory conditions of unveiling that are gifts, whereas maqam tends to allude to more permanent conditions of understanding that are, in some sense, earned through God's accepting various acts of worship, such as prayer, fasting, charity, seclusion, zikr, that is, remembrance, service, and so on, all of which can be done through modalities of observance that are accomplished with varying qualities of intention, commitment, and understanding. Various Sufis have put forth different sets of enumerations concerning the purported states and stations of the Sufi path. Although there might be varying degrees of overlap among such enumerated sets, nevertheless, each of these frameworks reflects the experiences of individuals, and if one takes seriously the Sufi maxim that God's disclosures never repeat themselves, then different ways of parsing mystical experience tend to reflect the journeys of individual human possibilities and potentials, rather than necessarily revealing a set of experiences that constitute a uniform and universal roadmap for traveling the Sufi path. There are many kinds of kashf, or spiritual unveiling, ilham, or flashes of spiritual intuition or insight, and tajali, or divine manifestation. In their own ways, kashf, ilham, and tajali are all modes of enlightenment, but they do not necessarily give expression to enlightenment in any final, definitive, and absolute sense. Moreover, one also should keep in mind that spiritual truths are capable of being engaged through different interior faculties of the individuals, such as the mind, heart, seer, and spirit. Therefore, a given truth can be understood in different ways by each of our interior faculties, and therefore human modes of understanding can refract the same light or nur of God in a multiplicity of ways. Most Sufis do accept the distinctions between the different levels of enlightenment involving the condition of fana and the condition of baka. Fana marks the passing away of the false self with the simultaneous process of becoming absorbed in the presence of divinity to such an extent that all else passes away from awareness, whereas baka alludes to modalities of realization concerning the presence of the essential self and the ways in which that presence reflects the names and attributes of divinity. Nevertheless, fana and baka are not necessarily the same for everyone who might be opened up to such possibilities. Individual capacity and divine grace are capable of modulating such spiritual conditions in different ways, even as there might be a certain amount of commonality and similarity with respect to some of the phenomenological features of those two general conditions. For example, some Sufis break down the stages of love in the following way: 1. Compatibility, 2. Inclination, 3. Fellowship, 4. Passion, 5. Friendship, 6. Exclusive friendship, 7. Ardent affection, 8. Enslavement, and finally 9. Bewilderment. Each of the foregoing stages gives expression to different dimensions of enlightenment that come through the spiritual condition of love. And yet in the highest form of enlightenment associated with the condition of love, The individual experiences bewilderment concerning the nature of the mystical disclosures that are being manifested by the beloved. In the light of the foregoing considerations, let's return to another question that was mentioned towards the beginning of this edition of Friday Thoughts. More specifically, are the terms mysticism and spirituality synonyms? That is, do they refer to more or less the same process? Perhaps one approach to describing the relationship of spirituality and mysticism is as follows. Although all mysticism gives expression to spirituality, not all spirituality necessarily gives expression to mysticism. As such, spirituality alludes to the idea that there is an important set of truths that exist beyond the exterior forms of religious worship, whereas mysticism gives expression to a path of experiential and epistemological realization concerning the nature of such truths. That is, mysticism is a methodological means for realizing the promise to which spirituality alludes. Given the foregoing possibility, what is one to make of the title of John Horgan's aforementioned book, Rational Mysticism: Spirituality Meets Science in the Search for Enlightenment? In what sense might spirituality meet science? A great deal depends on what one means by science. One possibility runs along the following lines. In his book, Horgan explores the scientific work of, among others, Michael Persinger, Franz Wallenweiden, and Andrew Newberg. Persinger uses a machine dubbed the God Machine to electromagnetically induce, allegedly, mystical experiences in individuals, whereas Wallenweiden's research involves attempting to map the neural circuits that supposedly are responsible for both blissful and nightmarish experiences, and Newberg's work is directed towards identifying the neural circuits that he believes are causally responsible for mystical experiences in meditating Buddhist monks and praying nuns. Other individuals explore the neurochemistry of chemicals such as mescaline, LSD, lysergic acid, DMT, dimethyltryptamine, and ayahuasca. The underlying assumptions of such research is that the altered states of consciousness associated with the ingestion of the foregoing sorts of chemicals is a function of biochemistry, and therefore mystical states are nothing more than the transformations in the neural circuitry of individuals. The problem with the research of people such as Persinger, Wallenweiden, and Newberg, as well as the work of those who theoretically are exploring the biochemistry of spirituality, is that no one has been able to establish a clear baseline for identifying what constitutes a mystical experience. All altered states of consciousness are being labeled as mystical experiences, and such an equivalency is not necessarily warranted. Secondly, there is a problem with claiming that spiritual or mystical states are being caused by electromagnetic stimulation, the ingestion of certain chemicals, or the activation of certain neural circuitry. At best, there is only a certain correlation between, on the one hand, the presence of, say, electromagnetic or chemical stimulation, and on the other hand, an altered state of consciousness of some kind. No one has been able to show how the phenomenological properties of a given experience, altered or otherwise, are shaped, organized, colored, and modulated by the presence of either a given form of electromagnetic or biochemical stimulation. It is a huge and very much unwarranted jump to try to claim that such stimulation is causing phenomenology to have the properties it is exhibiting, and moreover, as pointed out previously, even if one could prove that such electromagnetic and biochemical stimulation was the cause of any given altered state of consciousness, there is nothing to demonstrate that such altered states of consciousness are necessarily mystical in nature. There is another sense of science that might be much more relevant to the issues of spirituality and mysticism. This sense has to do with the methodological features that are inherent in the practice of science. More specifically, science encompasses a number of properties that are considered integral to such an understanding. For example, science is rooted in 1. Empirical observation, 2. the use of instrumentality. 3. Objectivity. 4. Recursive methodology. 5. Replication. And 6. Consensus among a community of experts or individuals who have deep knowledge concerning the practice of such a methodological process. Each of the foregoing facets of science has a rigorous counterpart on the mystical path. The Sufi path begins with observations concerning the experiences of life, and indeed every facet of lived experience comes under critical scrutiny. Moreover, just as material science spends some time cleaning and calibrating various instruments in order to get accurate readings or measurements concerning the experiences of life, so too the Sufi path gives considerable emphasis to the importance of cleaning and calibrating the inner faculties of mind, heart, seer, and spirit, or ruh, in order to acquire accurate readings concerning the experiences of life. In addition, although mysticism might appear to be inherently subjective, the fact of the matter is that the Sufis give a great deal of attention to eliminating all sources of possible bias, both from within as well as from without, that might interfere with having an objective understanding of any given experience. Consequently, a recursive methodology, that is, a process that generates results that are critically analyzed and then fed back into an underlying methodological process to develop a deeper, improved, and broader understanding, is used, which involves repeated activities such as fasting, seclusion, night vigils, service, remembrance, and so on, as a means of working towards a condition of heightened existential objectivity. Furthermore, just as it is the case in material science that unless one can replicate certain results, then one must continue to exercise a certain amount of caution concerning the viability of such an idea, so too practitioners of the Sufi path maintain that unless one replicates, within certain degrees of freedom, the findings of previous explorers of the mystical path, then one must exercise a certain amount of caution with respect to the nature of one's understanding concerning the Sufi path. And finally, one's journey along the mystical path should reflect the general values, principles, findings, and behavior of those who previously or currently have exhibited or are exhibiting demonstrable expertise in the realm of mysticism. Of course, just as there are so-called scientists who seek to give the appearance of having acquired certain results in a scientific manner, but have fudged their data and conclusions, so too there are so-called spiritually oriented individuals who seek to give the appearance of having acquired mystical realization without actually having done so. Just as there is junk science, there is junk mysticism, and it is not always easy for someone to distinguish between the two. When people take substances such as mescaline, LSD, DMT, and ayahuasca, also known as the vine of the dead, they believe they are communing with spirits and derive various ideas, values, principles, and insights from those engagements. Such altered states of consciousness can be profoundly intense and leave a lasting impression on the way a person looks at and interacts with life. All of the foregoing possibilities concerning experiences that constitute intense, meaningful forms of learning and insights might be true. However, to what extent mescaline, LSD, DMT, ayahuasca, or any other form of neural stimulation permits one to gain access to the deepest truths concerning human existence and the nature of reality is debatable. Going to university or joining an encounter group can lead to experiences that open one's eyes in profound and intense ways that one might not otherwise have considered had one not gone to university or spent time in an encounter group. However, to be open to various possibilities, whether in conventional or unconventional ways, does not make the insights or understandings arising out of such engagements either necessarily true or reflective of the ultimate nature of reality or human potential. Is mysticism just a different way of seeing, knowing, perceiving, or being, like sociology, psychology, physics, and economics are different ways of seeing, knowing, understanding, and orienting oneself with respect to life? Or does mysticism constitute an attempt to get to the bottom or essence of things as far as human existence and reality are concerned? If, ultimately, reality is not a function of material processes, and if mysticism is a methodological process for exploring such non-material phenomena, then science in its modern material sense is largely irrelevant to the mystical path. However, as the earlier outline concerning six of the basic features of science as a methodology indicated, to say that materialistic science has little relevance to mystical pursuits is not to say that rigorous, critical engagement of mystical methodology is impossible. As indicated earlier in this edition of Friday Thoughts, I'm not convinced that mysticism, even when done correctly, is capable of exhausting the truth. Abu Bakr Siddiq, may Allah be pleased with him, said that realization of our inability to attain comprehension of God is itself a form of comprehension. However, even though mystical practices might not be able to permit us to attain comprehension of God, I do believe that those practices, when done properly, open us up to the possibility of understanding the essential self and the potential for that self to engage and come to reflect to varying degrees certain aspects of the truth. When mysticism is pursued correctly, and this means, among other things, that the path or way is traveled under the close supervision of an authentic mystical guide, then mysticism constitutes a spiritual path directed towards helping an individual to attain whatever degree of enlightenment is consistent with that person's spiritual capacity and the divine grace that is extended to that individual with respect to realizing such a capacity, in whole or in part. In short, mysticism is a path that, God willing, takes one from surface forms back to the spiritual roots underlying those surface forms, and in the process brings one to a condition of realization and understanding concerning some of the hidden truths that are normally veiled by creation. There have been those individuals, such as Mansur al-Halaj, may Allah be pleased with him, through whom the words, quote, "I am the truth, an al-haq," end of quote, were issued, as well as Bayezid al-Bastami, may Allah be pleased with him, through whom the words, quote, "Holy am I, how great is my glory," end of quote, were given expression. There is considerable confusion arising in conjunction with such utterances. The foregoing sorts of sayings tend to scandalize the religiously minded because those statements seem to confuse, if not conflate, creation with creator. On the other hand, many mystics feel that the theologically and legalistically minded religious authorities fail to recognize the presence of the first part of the Shahada in the foregoing sorts of utterances, namely, bearing witness that there is no reality but God. In other words, all phenomena are just so many loci of manifestation for various arrangements of properties whose nature is a function of the interplay of divine names and attributes. Rabia of Basra was alluding to the foregoing sort of perspective when she said that, quote, "Thy existence is a sin with which none other can compare," end of quote. Many of us believe we have some sort of substantive reality when, in point of fact, we are but illusory manifestations or tajalli that are derived from and totally dependent on the creative imagination of divinity. The Sufi path is about learning how to remove the illusions that veil the presence of divinity. When illusions dissipate and many of our understandings concerning the nature of reality are mostly illusory in nature, what remains except the truth? Only those who have been provided by God with the necessary understanding to help an individual navigate her or his way through the hazardous waters that flow along the mystical path are authentic sheikhs. Such understanding contains the forms of reason and logic that help initiates of the Sufi way come to learn how to differentiate between the illusory and the real in the experiences of life. One cannot reason one's way to such an understanding. The understanding is a gift of grace that arises in whomever God pleases. An authentic spiritual guide is the trustworthy and reliable source of the sort of logic, reason, insight, and understanding that is needed by a seeker at any given stage of the mystical journey. This is the only sense in which the idea of, quote, rational mysticism, end of quote, has any significance on the Sufi path. Something is logical, reasoned, insightful, in a form of authoritative understanding only to the extent that it reflects the truth of a given phenomenon. If one is guided by an authentic shaykh, one has access to such logic, reasoning, insight, and understanding, and this is why a teacher, through God's grace, is able to guide a seeker. Without such an authentic shaykh, or worse, in the presence of a spiritual charlatan, one will become lost, for only authentic shaykhs are, by the grace of God, masters of the rigorous methodology of the mystical path. Only such individuals are practitioners of the science that gives expression to a mysticism that, when properly understood, is fully rational, but it is a form of rationality that transcends the reasoning of philosophers, theologians, and material scientists. From near the outer rim of the Milky Way galaxy, you are listening to the Sufi Study Circle podcast. This week's edition of Sufi Poets is entitled The Imposter, which appears in the book A Sufi Saint of the 20th Century by Martin Lings. But thou, hast thou sensed aught of what they perceive? If thou art as they, then authority is thine. But if thou findest nothing in thyself of what is theirs, then claim justice from thy soul. Heed this description. Hast thou folded up the world out of sight with one look? Witness the All-Merciful where manifest he is. Hast effaced mankind from thy ken with one glance, and strayed beyond the bounds of all, beyond the heights of heaven and earth's deep? The whole universe hast encompassed with full pilgrimal visitation, and hath that same universe made thee its shrine, the holy axis of its reverential orbit? Have the screens vanished from before thee in thine honor? Hath the cloak been thrown off, the veil set aside? And hath it been said unto thee, draw nigh, here is our beauty, welcome, enjoy it as thine, at thy most intimate ease? Hath the summoner summoned thee, and hast moved to his command? Hast doffed thy sandals as one that is steeped in the courtesies of the path? Hath the infinite closed around thee on all sides? And when the moment came for union, didst to it lean with all thy bent? Hast kept faithfully the secrets of God after its revelation, robing thyself in his qualities? All this would be some evidence of thy nearness, else there are secrets which are not for the many. If to this description thou answered, then all hail. If not, then art thou far from the presence of the Lord? Stand away from the lore of the folk, thou art not of them, nor lay hands on the heritage of the orphan, offense most grievous. Unto God it is hateful to put painted promises in the place of deeds. What use is a tongue that in euphemies is fluent? What good to over a gild gashes and not heal them? Doth aught but his cure avail the sick man? Doth the exile take delight in an alien folk? Rehearse well thy speech, thou canst talk as they talk, but 'tis the hornet's wax, not the honeycomb of the bee. When I served as chairperson of the Sufi Study Circle more than 25 years ago, in relation to the meetings that were held at the University of Toronto's International Student Center near the corner of St. George and College Street, The gatherings featured relatively brief readings from the Sufi literature, both ancient and modern. Such readings were intended to serve as a source of information, as well as constituting stimuli for subsequent meditation and critical reflection. Sometimes such readings would lead to an ensuing discussion, and sometimes they were followed by an extended silence as individuals sought to digest what had been said in a given reading. Although the nature of the present podcast format is such that it is not interactive in the way the real-world version of the Sufi Study Circle was many years ago, nonetheless, some of the flavor of the original meetings can be conveyed by providing a weekly excerpt from one or another great Sufi teacher of the past. The perspective that was expressed in the introduction to the previous section featuring great Sufi poets remains in effect in this portion of the Sufi Study Circle. In other words, do not take the prose passages that are stated in the following excerpt from the Sufi literature as being authoritative because this or that Sufi sheikh or spiritual guide said it. Listen to the following passage from an orientation that is prepared to undertake the struggle that is necessary to try to follow the words back to their nonverbal origins. The words of the Sufi teachers are surface indicators of a journey that is largely nonverbal. Those words are intended to serve as visible signposts of sorts that point in the direction of a seemingly contradictory state of affairs, that ultimately the nature of truth transcends all possibility of verbal communication and as such is ineffable and shrouded in mystery. This does not mean that one can make truth anything one likes. Irrespective of whether or not we grasp how the universe operates on any or all of its metaphysical levels, the truth concerning such operations does exist. Reality does have a determinate nature. The Sufi guides have always been very clear that the journey to the truth can never be completed without appropriate and informed assistance. Nonetheless, one can at least begin a portion of the spiritual journey by reflecting on what has been said by travelers of the Sufi mystical path. The following selection for this week's edition of Traditional Readings is Chapter 18 from Signs of the Unseen, The Discourses of Jalaluddin Rumi, translated by W. M. Thaxton, Jr. Ibn Mukri reads the Quran correctly. That is, he reads the form of the Quran correctly, but he hasn't a clue as to the meaning. The proof of this lies in the fact that when he does come across a meaning, he rejects it. He reads without insight, blindly. He is like a man who holds a sable in his hand. If offered a better sable, he rejects it. We realize, therefore, that he does not know sable. Someone has told him that what he has is sable, and so he holds on to it in blind imitation. It is like children playing with walnuts. If offered walnut oil or walnut kernels, they will reject them because for them a walnut is something that rolls and makes a noise, and those other things do not roll or make noises. God's treasure houses are many, and God's knowledge is vast. If a man reads one Quran knowledgeably, why should he reject any other Quran? I once said to a Quran reader, quote, "The Quran says, say, if the sea were ink to write the words of my Lord, verily the sea would fail before the words of my Lord would fail." End of quote. Now, for 50 grams of ink, one can write out the whole Quran. This is but a symbol of God's knowledge. It is not the whole of his knowledge. If a druggist put a pinch of medicine in a piece of paper, would you be so foolish as to say that the whole of the drugstore is in this paper? In the time of Moses, Jesus, and others, the Quran existed. That is, God's word existed. It simply wasn't in Arabic. That is what I tried to make the Quran reader understand. But when I saw that it was having no effect on him, I left. It is said that during the time of the apostle, the companions who memorized a chapter or half a chapter of the Quran were deemed extraordinary and were objects of admiration. They did this because they devoured the Quran. Now anyone who can devour a pound or two of bread can be called extraordinary, but a person who just puts bread in his mouth and spits it out without chewing and swallowing can devour thousands of tons. It is about such a one that is said, quote, many a reader of the Quran is cursed by the Quran, end of quote. That is, one who is not aware of the real meaning. Yet it is well that this is so. God shut some people's eyes in heedlessness in order for them to make the world flourish. If some people were not heedless of the next world, then no world would be built up here. Such heedlessness initiates worldliness. A child grows up in heedlessness. When his mind reaches maturity, he does not grow anymore. The cause and originator of his growing is heedlessness, while the cause for the lack of growth is awareness. What we say does not go beyond two cases. We speak either out of envy or out of compassion. God forbid it be out of envy, because what is worthy of being envied is so destroyed by envy that it no longer is enviable. And then what is it? On the other hand, there are compassion and intercession, by means of which I wish to attract my dear friends to the concept. The story is told of a man who wandered into the desert on his way to the pilgrimage and was overcome by great thirst. Finally, at a distance, he saw a ragged little tent. Going there and seeing a woman, he cried out, I can receive hospitality, just what I needed. And then he descended. He asked for water, but the water they gave him was hotter than fire and more brackish than salt, and it burned his throat as it went down. Out of compassion, he began to advise the woman, saying, I am obliged to you insofar as I have been comforted by you, and my compassion for you has been stirred. Take heed, therefore, of what I say to you. The cities of Baghdad, Kufa, and Wasit are nearby. If you are in dire straits, you can get yourselves there in a few marches, where there is much sweet, cool water. And he also listed to her the great variety of foods, bathhouses, luxuries, and pleasures of those cities. A moment later, her Bedouin husband arrived. He had caught a few desert rats, which he told the woman to cook. They gave some to the guest, who, destitute as he was, could not refuse. Later that night, while the guest was asleep outside the tent, the woman said to her husband, You've never heard the likes of the tales this man has been telling. And she told her husband everything he had related to her. Don't listen to such things, the Bedouin said. There are many envious people in the world, and when they see others enjoying ease and comfort, they grow envious and want to deprive them of their enjoyment. People are just like that. When someone advises them out of compassion, they attribute it to envy. If, on the other hand, one has a basis, in the end one will turn to substance. Since on the day of Allah a drop was sprinkled on such a man, in the end that drop will deliver him from confusion and tribulation. Come now, how long will you remain estranged from us in your confusion and melancholy? What, on the other hand, is one to say to a people who have never heard the likes of it, neither from him nor from their own teachers? Quote, there being no greatness among his forebears, he cannot abide to hear the great mentioned. End of quote. To turn to the substance of a thing, although not pleasant at first, becomes sweeter the further you go. In contrast, form appears beautiful at first, but the more you stay with it, the more disenchanted with it you become. What is the form of the Quran in comparison with its substance? Look into a man to see what his form is and what his substance is. If the substance of a man's form were to go away, he would not be let loose in the house for even a moment. Maulana Shamsuddin used to tell of a large caravan en route to a certain place that could find neither settlement nor water. Suddenly they came across a well that had no means for drawing water. They brought a bucket and some rope and let the bucket down into the well. When they started to draw it up, the rope broke. They let down another bucket, but it too broke loose. Then they tied some of the members of the caravan to the rope and lowered them into the well. but they did not come back up either. An intelligent man among them said, "I'll go." So they lowered him down. When he was almost to the bottom, a horrible black thing appeared. "I'll never escape from this," said the man. "Yet let me gather my wits and not go to pieces so I can see what is going to happen to me." "There is no use making a ruckus," the black thing said. "You are my prisoner and will never go free unless you give me a correct answer." "What is your question?" "What is the best place?" it asked. Here, the intelligent man thought, I am helpless as his prisoner. If I say Baghdad or any other place, it will be as though I have insulted his place. Therefore, he said, the best place is where one is at home. If it is in the depths of the earth, that's the best. If it's in a mouse hole, that's the best. Well said the thing. You are free. You are a real man. I free not only you, but also the others for your sake. Henceforth, I will shed no more blood. Because of my love for you, I bestow upon you the lives of all of the men in the world. And he gave the people of the caravan all the water they wanted. Now the purport of all of this is the intrinsic meaning. One can express this very same intrinsic meaning in another form, but those who adhere to convention can have it only their way. It is difficult to talk to them. If you say the same thing another way, they won't listen. Over the years, and by the grace of Allah, thousands of my books have been purchased by people, as well as a few libraries, located in 20 to 25 countries around the world, from Senegal to Norway, Australia, Japan, Mexico, Brazil, England, Denmark, Germany, South Africa, New Zealand, and more. It might sound impressive, but if I had to live off the proceeds from such books, I would have perished a long time ago had not God found other means of financial support for me. Individually, the books cost anywhere from $7.95 to $25. If a person were to buy the entire collection of books in a real-world format, or even in a virtual format, one would have to spend somewhere around $300. Relatively recently, I have put together a software package that contains the entire collection of the 33 books that, up to the present time, have been issued through me. In addition, I have added 33 pieces of floetry, that is, poems combining rhythm, rhyme, and music, some of which have been featured in the Sufi Study Circle podcast, that if purchased via CD would cost another $20 or so, as well as I have included a number of videos, one of which appears on a DVD that previously was released to the public and goes for around $13. The foregoing software package is priced at $19.95. This constitutes a saving of over $300 when calculated in terms of the cost of the items contained within the software package had they been purchased individually. The software package is entitled Sufi Reflections. If you are interested in obtaining a copy of the software package for 1995, please go to http://anab-whitehouse.com for further information. I don't know of any other person within the Muslim community, at least in North America and perhaps beyond, who has released such an array of diverse, high-quality writings. The topics range from 9/11 to Sharia, psychology, evolution, education, political science, constitutional law, quantum physics, spiritual abuse, cosmology, mysticism, leadership, Islam, moral philosophy, mythology, and history. There is a great deal of food for thought in the foregoing material that is of relevance to and perhaps value for the Muslim community. I might not have all the answers or even any of them. Nonetheless, the aforementioned software package, Sufi Reflections, should, God willing, induce a person to reconsider a great many ideas. I'm not trying to reinvent or reinterpret the Islamic spiritual tradition. Instead, I am trying to draw attention to a variety of issues, ideas, and problems that might adversely affect the way an individual engages Islam. Although I do not have the talent or spiritual stature of Rumi, Hafiz, or even my own spiritual guide, may God be pleased with them all, nevertheless, from time to time, the impetus to write poetry has arisen within me. I have joined such efforts to various musical backgrounds, produced a combination of rhythm, rhyme, and musical overtones that I refer to as floetry, which, in a way, sort of harkens back to the Beat Generation of the late 1940s and early 1950s, when individuals would recite their poetical compositions against the backdrop of the improvised offerings of a group of jazz musicians that shared the stage with the poet. Some of the poems that will appear in this section of the Sufi Study Circle podcast are inspired by life events of my own, while other poems are rooted in the teachings of great spiritual luminaries of the past. In the latter case, I have run someone else's understanding through the filters of my own limitations, but have tried as best I can to retain the spirit of the ideas and sensibilities that were given expression to the original poems or prose of some great Sufi of the past. The title of the following poem is The Way Home. Choice is a space with many rooms, yet with just two ways to go. A maze into which we are born with limited time to know how to proceed. Our life is torn between lower and higher entreaties that caress our heart, callings to which we aspire, potentials that set us apart, and journeys that twist and turn among fates that mark boundaries within which we move and learn, like lowly oars in dark foundries, so fragile, easy to break. Each soul needs work and grace to bring out its value, a high-stake drama which takes flight on the wing of time that, like a midwife, delivers from darkness to light. The changing rhythms of life to which we struggle to gain sight of our core self, of why we are, and all that these truths entail. Take warning. The web of free will is subtle and spreads its tail across cosmic filaments, vibrating human intentions that form living testaments brought forth by divine conventions on a day we all must face. This portion of the Sufi Studies Circle podcast involves a brief essay or commentary on topics of importance to everyday life. Every point of the Sufi mystical path is commensurate with principles and values that have practical ramifications for lived life, since the primary measure of practicality will, to one degree or another, always be a function of the truth. Real pragmatism must be rooted in an understanding concerning the forces that impinge on our lives, both from within and without. The essays or commentaries of this segment of the program are intended to probe different dimensions of everyday life from a Sufi perspective. The title of today's rendition of Meditative Essays is Betrayal. We live in an age of betrayal. This disease has diffused into virtually every nook and cranny of society. There are few, if any, people whose lives have not been affected in one way or another by its presence. In fact, for the vast majority of us, betrayal comes at us from a wide variety of angles, both from within as well as from outside of us. Husbands betray wives, and wives betray husbands. The nature of the betrayal involves more than sexual infidelities, although that is in itself a source of deep injury and trauma. Husbands and wives also betray one another when they lose interest in the other person as a human being, and therefore become increasingly open to sacrificing their spouse's essential needs for purely transitory, worldly gains or material sensory gratification. Parents betray children when they abuse them sexually, physically, and emotionally. Parents betray children when they abdicate responsibility for nurturing the developmental well-being of the child and turn that task over to television or expect schools to accomplish the task unassisted. Parents betray children by drifting into drug and alcohol-induced stupors, as well as career addictions, bequeathing to their children little more than a psychological, emotional, and spiritual wasteland. Elected officials betray voters through failure to keep election promises. Elected officials betray their constituents by placing their own interests above that of the people they are supposed to serve. Elected officials betray their communities by allowing the special interests of the few to take precedence over the needs of the many. Elected officials betray their supporters by becoming involved in politics rather than implementing the true spirit of public service. Native peoples in North America have been betrayed consistently by governments and non-native people. In fact, indigenous people everywhere in the world have been betrayed by their non-indigenous, quote-unquote, neighbors. Corporations have betrayed their workers by exposing the latter to all manner of hazardous, unsafe, and toxic working conditions. Adding insult to injury, many of these same corporations do not offer a fair day's wage for a fair day's labor. Many companies have betrayed the communities in which they reside as a result of being more concerned about profits than the pollution and ecological destruction which underwrites those profits. Corporations have betrayed the communities in which they exist through the manner in which they threaten, badger, corrupt, and terrorize those communities in order to get tax breaks, as well as government concessions concerning the enforcement of regulations involving safety and pollution. Lawyers betray their clients when the former violate their fiduciary responsibilities to the latter. These betrayals range from embezzling funds to cutting deals which are not necessarily in their clients' best interest, to going through the motions and thereby cheating their clients of commitment, energy, and an effort worthy of the money they are being paid. Lawyers have betrayed the communities in which they practice by helping to create and perpetuate the mess that we call our judicial system. More than a few therapists have betrayed their clients. More than a few doctors have betrayed their patients. More than a few banks have betrayed their customers. More than a few educators have betrayed their students. More than a few religious leaders have betrayed their congregations. More than a few leaders have betrayed their countries. More than one race has betrayed people of other races. More than a few papers have betrayed their readers. More than a few pro athletes have betrayed their fans. More than a few friends have betrayed their comrades. Seemingly, there is no end to the list of betrayals which shape, color, and modulate so much of our lives. However, there exists one kind of betrayal without which none of the foregoing myriad forms of betrayals likely would occur. Most of us betray ourselves. We betray our essence. We betray our spiritual potential. We betray our true identities. We betray our humanity. We betray our integrity and character and honor. We betray our relationship with God. One cannot betray others unless one has first betrayed oneself. Once one has betrayed oneself, everyone else is relatively easy. If one is willing to betray oneself, who does not become a target of opportunity for such treachery? If one cannot prevent oneself from betraying oneself, how can one stop oneself from betraying other people? We betray others and ourselves through our insensitivities and selfishness. We betray others and ourselves through our emotional immaturity. We betray others and ourselves through our broken promises, commitments, and undertakings. We betray others and ourselves through the absence of love in our lives. We betray others and ourselves through our failure to be forgiving, patient, honest, forbearing, compassionate, and generous. We betray others and ourselves through our refusal to be understanding and encouraging and supportive. The Sufi path is designed to assist the individual to learn, among other things, how to stop betraying himself or herself. Sufi masters help us to become aware of the sources of such betrayal, as well as to help us to become sensitized to the way in which the betrayal process works. Through God's blessings of support, the teachers of the Sufi path lead people towards an understanding of what self-respect and self-esteem entail. Once we come to an essential appreciation of what and whom the true self is, we will have developed, God willing, a powerful antidote to the disease of betraying ourselves and others. The terrible condition of the world is as it is because our spiritual conditions are what they are. Each person is responsible for his or her contribution of betrayal to the day-to-day life of the world. If we want the world to change, we must first change ourselves. We must learn how to stop betraying ourselves so that we can stop betraying others. Today's offering for the It Has Been Said portion of the Sufi Study Circle podcast is as follows. The world has no substantive reality. Rather, it exists as a shadowy play. The following segment of the Sufi Study Circle podcast is a brief prayer that is offered on behalf of whomever might have managed to survive to this portion of the program. O Allah, your friend has said that hardness of heart is caused by an inability to weep, so grant us the gift of tears. And your friend has said that hardness of heart is caused by a multiplicity of sins, so assist us to struggle against committing such sins. And our Lord, your friend, has said that committing a multiplicity of sins is due to the forgetfulness of death, so instill in us an awareness that death could come at any moment. And O our Lord, your friend has indicated that the reason why people forget that death is near at hand is due to ambitious expectations concerning the future, so help us to withdraw from having such expectations. And O our Lord, your friend has said that excessive expectations concerning the future is due to having love for this world, so help us to learn to long for you and not the world. This week's edition of the Sufi Study Circle podcast has been brought to you by the Interrogative Imperative Institute, where the process of asking questions becomes an artful journey to solutions for life. You have been listening to the Sufi Study Circle podcast. The host for this program, namely yours truly, is neither a sheikh nor a spiritual guide, nor am I equipped to advise anyone where she or he might be able to formally step onto the Sufi path. When I stumbled into the spiritual tavern of my sheikh, I had no idea what I was doing or how I had found such an establishment. When my sheikh passed away, there were no provisions left in place for anyone else to assume his responsibilities in the future. Since his passing away, I have come to learn, in a very close-up and problematic way, that there are spiritual charlatans who are constantly trolling the waters of existence for vulnerable prey. While I believe there still are authentic spiritual guides who exist in various parts of the world, and unfortunately are becoming fewer in number, I do not have confidence in recommending this or that person as being an authentic sheikh, which is not to say that such people aren't legitimate, but rather it is to say that I do not feel comfortable in recommending them to anyone as individuals for whom I could give assurances that they are people on whom one can rely spiritually. The contents of the program are intended merely as food for thought. While such food might induce someone to want to journey beyond the very limited horizons of the podcast, please keep in mind that I am of the understanding that the Sufi path cannot be traversed without an authentic spiritual guide. And unfortunately, as indicated previously, there are many fraudulent teachers who are actively seeking opportunities to misguide people and thereby not only muddying the spiritual waters, but attempting to corrupt, if not destroy, the spiritual potential of unsuspecting people. Information concerning past editions of the Sufi Study Circle can be found by going to anab-whitehouse.com/circle, that's capital C, small I-R-C-L-E dot H-T-M. Thank you for your time, and perhaps we will convene again in the future during some further, God willing, edition of the Sufi Study Circle podcast.